This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo Ann. As Malaysians, food is an integral part of our lives, but what if the food isn't what it's purported to be? Food fraud is a real problem globally and in Malaysia as well, but many of us are often unaware of when it happens and its potentially harmful effects. So in the studio with me today is Dr. Sanju Lin, who is a next-generation sequencing scientist, to help us find out more about what food fraud is and when it happens. So welcome to the show, Julin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today.
This is very curious of me, but next generation sequencing scientist, what is it that you do?
All right. So when we talk about next generation sequencing scientist, so in short, NGS. Mm-hmm. All right, I'll just refer to NGS from here on.
Yep.
It is actually a DNA sequencing method. So, I mean, are you familiar with forensics? Like when mm-hmm. we talk about forensics, we talk about DNA.
Yeah.
We talk about sequencing the DNA to find out to which person this DNA belongs to. So usually the conventional method will just be sequencing one DNA at a time.
Mm-hmm.
But when we talk about NGS, it is essentially sequencing multiple DNAs at a time. So that is essentially more effective and efficient. So yeah, I think that NGS is really commonly used in research in Malaysia, in like cancer research, because they want to look for markers that can lead to cancer progression. But not, I don't think there's anyone who's using NGS in the non-medical sector.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I thought, you know, like we thought that using NGS in this area of food safety, I think that's really interesting because no one has looked at it. And I think it is really good to use the robustness of DNA sequencing to mm-hmm. try combating food fraud.
That is quite interesting because usually when you mention DNA, the first thing people think about is humans or animals.
Yes,
or
yes.
These type of living things and their DNA. We don't realize that, you know, food also has DNA.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So going back to our topic today, we are talking about food fraud. Perhaps first, could you tell us what is food fraud?
Okay. So there are a lot of definitions to food fraud. Like if you look up food fraud on the internet, you mm-hmm. will come up with a lot of results telling you what food fraud is. But I like to just really use this, the most common and potentially the official definition of food fraud. The term was coined by Dr. John Spink and Douglas C. Moyer of the Michigan State University in 2011. So food fraud is a collective term used to encompass the deliberate and intentional substitution or misrepresentation of food ingredients, or misleading statements made about a product for economic gain.
Mm.
So when we talk about food fraud, it's usually about the intentional act of adulteration mm-hmm. for economic gains. So people are not really adulterating the food for the purpose of harming someone else. So it's really purely for economic purposes. However, sometimes when the food is being adulterated with certain components and substances, it will have some impact on one's health.
Mm.
So this is like an indirect effect of food fraud. And I think that, you know, in terms of food fraud, I mean, it's something that we hear quite often, perhaps.
Yeah.
And when we are talking about, you know, it being in Malaysia, like whether it's like how big is it in Malaysia, right? Because I think that's what people want to know. I think this is quite a subjective matter because, I mean, we all have like different definitions of big, but it does happen in Malaysia. So in 2016, the Food and Agriculture Organization, they reported that in Malaysia, 16% of frozen and processed seafood are adulterated. Last year, there was a food packaging facility in Puchong that got into hot soup because mm-hmm. they were pretty much using false halal logo. And also coffee laced with a compound that can be found in Viagra. So that's like, you know, toxic substance.
Mm.
So yeah, I mean, it does happen in Malaysia.
Just going back to one of the points you made. So you mentioned intentional. So does that mean that if it's unintentional, it's not considered food fraud?
So in a way, yes, because this is something that is unintentionally introduced. So food fraud, yes, when we talk about food fraud, it's usually the intentional act.
So, you know, you've mentioned a few examples, but so economic gains is usually, is that the main reason behind food fraud?
Yes, it is. Yes, that's because it is usually about, it's for economic gains. Because if it is about deliberately harming somebody, then that would be called food bioterrorism. But yes, it's really for economic gains.
Talking about food fraud, I mean, the flip side to that is food transparency, knowing more details about your food. What do we mean by food transparency? Why is it important for us to have that?
So food transparency is important. Because, I mean, we as consumers, like we as the end users of the food, we want to know what are we consuming or what are we buying. So if I walk into a supermarket today and I want to buy, say, a bottle of olive oil, so I want to look for something that's like 100% virgin olive oil. So I'll go to the shelves and I look at all the bottles of oil. And if, let's say, the bottle is just labeled oil, I wouldn't know what type of oil it is. So I need to know what sort of oil that I'm purchasing. So food transparency, I mean, the most direct way of helping with that is the proper labeling of food products. Because then this will help the consumers make informed decisions whether they want to buy the product or not. And of course, I think one of the most important aspect when it comes to labeling is to declare whether that product has traces of allergens or not. And I think it would be very important for the label to be to clearly state that there could be traces of peanuts or wheat or any type of allergen that's there.
Because especially for people who have severe allergic reactions, you really don't want them to develop that when they eat your food.
No, we don't want that, no.
So we do have to go for a quick break. I've been speaking to Next Generation Sequencing Scientist Dr. Tan Ju Lin about food fraud. So we've spoken about what food fraud is, the importance of food transparency, and we'll come back to find out more about the different types of food fraud and how it impacts both our health and the economy. So you're listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo Ann. In the studio with me is Dr. Tan Ju Lin. She's a next generation sequencing scientist, and we've been talking about food fraud. So you've mentioned a few examples of food fraud, but I know how many different types of food frauds are there?
Well, probably five. I'll talk about five different types today. So let's go through the first one, substitution. All right, so when we talk about substitution, it is essentially about replacing an item with something else. So that's substitution. So in the context of food fraud, there are a lot of meat that look the same. So I'll just ask you, can you tell the difference between salmon and trout?
That's quite difficult, isn't it? Because they're both orangey pink in colour.
Yes, that's right. So it is very easy for someone to just substitute the salmon with trout. Mm. But however, this is quite dangerous because trout is more susceptible to parasites.
Right.
And salmon is the safer choice. So salmon is usually used in sushi and it's eaten raw. Mm. So imagine if someone eats the raw piece of trout, they could be susceptible to parasitic infection because of that. And another example would be buffalo meat. So this is something actually quite interesting. We actually, a couple of months ago, we actually did tests on some in-house samples. Mm-hmm. So we just randomly took some, bought some samples from malls, from stores, just to test how NGS works. So then we bought this packet of minced beef. So it was labeled as minced beef. But when we tested it, it was actually buffalo. So, yeah, I mean, both of them are red meat and they are from the same family. So I think that's also another example where, you know, you can, you may find it difficult to distinguish the both of them. And also peppercorns substituted with papaya seed. So peppercorns, they are rounded, black, and perhaps a bit wrinkly maybe. And papaya seed, of course, when you look at it fresh like that, it's not as wrinkly, it's still quite smooth. But when you, so I actually looked up online, there's this girl who did an experiment. Mm-hmm. She dried the papaya seeds and it turned a little wrinkly. And then she just mixed it with like a bunch of peppercorns. And then you can't tell them apart anymore. Like you do not know which are the peppercorns, which are the papaya seeds. So now imagine if that's being ground, like if you grind that up.
Yeah.
So it's going to be like powdery, black, you can't tell it anymore.
Right.
Yeah, so that happens as well. Okay, and another example, we're still talking about substitution.
Right.
Is in 2015, there was a case of cumin being mixed with peanut shells.
Cumin and peanut shells?
Exactly. All right, so cumin, you know, powdered cumin is brownish, yellowish.
Mm-hmm.
Right, peanut shells, like the husk, you know, if you grind it up, it's going to be having that sort of similar texture, color, and you just mix it with the cumin. They did this to try to upsell their cumin, like by adding some peanuts. But this is quite dangerous because, you know, like we talked about just now, some people may have
allergies.
Yes. So that's really dangerous. So that's it with the substitution. So the next one is concealment. When we talk about concealment, we are saying that we're trying to hide something. So we're trying to conceal something. This could be applying food colouring.
Mm-hmm.
Right, food colouring to the food products. However, if this food colouring is, it can cause allergic reaction too. I mean, as a kid, I was actually allergic to food colouring.
Right.
Yeah, I actually developed rash. So just things like that, if it's not being declared on the label that, you know, it has this type of food colouring and all, so this person might develop allergic reaction to it. And then we have dilution. So the third example is dilution. When we talk about dilution, so we are saying that we are reducing a certain effect. Okay, so I'll go back to the example of the extra virgin olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really expensive oil. I mean, olive oil, we don't see people using it for deep frying or stir frying. It's probably just on salad and pasta. So it's really expensive. However, there are some cases where people actually take out probably a quarter of the amount of the olive oil and replace it with a lower quality oil so that it's cheaper to produce, but they're selling it at a higher price. So that's where they can get the economic gains.
Right, because usually when you go to the supermarket and you look at the oil section, especially when you look at the olive oil, it all just looks the same to me at least.
To me too.
Yeah, so if you mix it, I guess most people can't tell the difference.
Yes, it will be really difficult. So that's really tricky. Fourth example is unapproved enhancement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this one is probably the most popular example is melamine in milk products.
In the baby milk powder,
yes,
was it?
Yeah. Yes, and there was a case in 2008, 2009, that there was this case where there was melamine poisoning resulted in, I think 60,000 babies got affected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was a serious case. So it is to really apply synthetic dyes to enhance product color or putting in poisonous compounds such as something that you can find in Viagra into coffee.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a case last year that some of the coffee products got recalled because they found this compound in the coffee. So yeah, so that's those are the examples of unapproved enhancement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the last one that I like to talk about is probably also the most common thing that is occurring. It's mislabeling in general.
Mm.
So mislabeling, like I've mentioned earlier, is people want food transparency. They want to see proper labeling.
Yes.
So if you mislabel something like on purpose, then that could have like a detrimental consequences. For example, like that in the seafood industry, some of the fish can be sold as like a lower quality fish.
Mm-hmm.
So they just like, I mean, it's really difficult to tell, especially when it's processed seafood, because when it's processed, everything gets mashed up and people can just put whatever they want on the label and we won't be able to tell.
And it's similar to what you mentioned earlier about substitution, isn't it? The papaya seeds and the cumin and the peanut shells. It's a lot of it, from what I understand, it's a lot of it is all the ground up stuff. So by the time, like the minced beef, time you ground it, you mince it, you can't really separate it and tell the difference anymore.
Yes, that's right. That's right. It's really difficult. Yeah, especially when it's in the form of powder and minced meat. Yes.
What are the potential harmful effects that could emerge from this?
All right. So I think the three main things that can happen is firstly, there'll be a loss of customers' trust.
Mm-hmm.
So if ever the food is being adulterated and this company, you know, got caught and like, so the customers will lose their trust in the product. So this will then lower the economic value of what they're trying to sell in the future. But I think that one of the lesser talked about is the health impact consequences.
Mm-hmm.
Because, when, you know, like I mentioned earlier, food fraud is about the intentional substitution for economic gains. But it does have an indirect effect on our health if the product contains substances or compounds that are dangerous.
Mm.
So the first one that I mentioned earlier about the melamine.
Yes.
Yeah, so that was a serious case. And then there's also some cases in Bangladesh where people actually got puffer fish poisoning.
Right.
Right. So puffer fish is like a very finicky type of fish. Like
It's the Japanese delicacy, isn't it? It's the poisonous one.
Yes, the poisonous one. So if it's not prepared well, I think that the poison will still be retained in the fish.
Mm.
So in 2008, there was a case where I think there were 141 cases of puffer fish poisoning. That was in 2008, Bangladesh. And also in United States in 2007, there were some of their products. They were labeled as monk fish, but they are actually puffer fish.
So these are all also mislabeling of the product itself.
Yes, that's right. So they claim to be selling this type of fish. Instead, they're all like puffer fish.
Mm.
So that's that's like a mislabeling. And also, I mean, I think there are cases where tuna is also being replaced by escola.
Is that also a type of fish?
Yeah, it's kind of like a type of whitish fish. And the thing is, the overconsumption of this fish can result in gastrointestinal problems. So, you know, you don't want to be consuming too much of that. Also, there's this thing that is a bit, probably doesn't occur as much, but there's star anise. So if you look up on the internet, you look at Chinese star anise and Japanese star anise, you can't really tell the difference, like visually.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at them, they will still have that spikes and they're brown in color. However, the Japanese star anise is actually poisonous. It's not edible.
Oh, okay. So the ones that we usually use is actually the Chinese one.
Yes. That's right. So the Chinese ones are edible and it gives a really nice smell. But Japanese star anise is toxic. So it can cause inflammation in kidneys and the digestive organs. And there was a study in United States. Like they were just, they wanted to check how often this star anise is, you know, adulterated. So they actually found that star anise adulteration did occur, and it actually caused some of the infants to suffer from neurologic toxicities. So that's in, you know, a study done in the United States. But I think that this is quite uncommon, although this is just something that is worth taking note about because they look so alike. And so this is where the chances of the product being adulterated is higher.
Mm. I think that's especially quite it's something I never thought about because it's star anise is something that you use so often in your cooking, especially here in Malaysian cooking.
Yes.
And then to know that there is actually another variant which is poisonous.
Yeah.
It's quite scary.
Yes.
So then, you know, we've talked a lot about all these different types of food fraud, you know, what consequences it will have. But in cases like this, right, how is it usually detected? Is it always only when something harmful happens?
So I can't tell for everyone for sure, like all the parties for sure. But okay, I think in general, though, I mean, Malaysians and the authorities, they are aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they are actually taking steps to try curbing all these things from happening. But I think that sometimes, you know, like when we don't see it happening, we don't really care too much yet.
Yeah.
And until something happens, then we do something about it. So again, I can't comment on behalf of the Malaysian food operators here. But I think in general, some people are just more of the reactive type and a preventive type, so they don't take measures to prevent it from happening. Rather, they take action only when it happens.
Mm.
And I think this is this could be the reason why there's this horse meat scandal that happened, I think, a couple of years.
In Europe, right?
Yeah, yes, yes.
It was, I think it was supposed to be beef, but then they found that it contained horse meat instead.
Yes, that's right. So I believe that this wouldn't have... The chances of this happening would have been reduced if they had actually checked the incoming raw materials before actually making all these patties and everything.
Mm.
So I think some people are still quite... they still, just sit back and wait until something happens. Then only they do something about it.
So do we have any standards when it comes to, food safety and managing food fraud?
Yes. There are a few common ones. Like we have HACCP.
Mm-hmm.
So that's hazard analysis and critical control points. So this regulation has been set up, and it's to emphasize on food safety related mm-hmm. to microbiological standards. So such as pathogen control, then you want to monitor the environment, cleaning and sanitation of the equipments. So this HACCP guide actually helps in ensuring the food safety standards are, like the Malaysian food safety standard is reached. And then we have Food Hygiene Regulation 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So that is also related to food safety. So if someone is planning to come up with a type of food, they need to make sure that that food is safe, like it doesn't have any dangerous bacteria. Also, there's Food Act 1983.
Mm-hmm.
This act is enforced by the Ministry of Health, especially specifically the Food Safety and Quality Division. So these three are probably the three most common or the major regulations that that has been enforced to ensure food safety. However, these regulations do not actually help in combating food fraud.
And why is that?
Because food safety, in this case, it could be an accidental introduction of pathogen during the food preparation.
Mm-hmm.
However, food fraud is more of the intentional adulteration of food.
Right.
Yeah, so when we talk about food safety, it's usually about... it's really, really focusing on the microbiological aspects of mm-hmm. food. However, in terms of food fraud, there's something called a VACCP. So that is called the Vulnerability Assessment Critical Control Point.
Mm-hmm.
So VACCP, what it does is that it is enforced to determine where are the vulnerable points in the supply chain. So with this, then, it's essentially auditing the supply chain, the whole supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
So vulnerability risks such as business pressures. So sometimes, let's say, a business is pushed to produce a certain product and they don't have that much with them at that time. So they could be pushed to a point where they will try to adulterate it to come up with something. So this mm-hmm. is like business pressure. And I think that these are like pretty much the regulations and standards that are currently available.
So the Food Hygiene and the Food Act are the regulations, but for the HACCP and the VACCP, are those just guidelines or must they adhere to that?
So for the HACCP, like the food operators have to adhere to that because HACCP is essentially the main guideline for food operators to follow so that what they are producing is safe for consumption. Now, speaking of guidelines, I mean, the guidelines will always be there. Like, we'll always have the regulation and standards. But I think the most important thing is the enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
So, if the guideline is there, regulation is there, but if the enforcement is lacking, then these guides, they are not very useful after all.
Mm. So you mentioned the Food Act and all that. It's more on food safety. But is food? Do we know if food fraud is criminalized in Malaysia?
Yes, actually, in Food Act 1983, so there's this section. It's under offences.
Mm-hmm.
It actually clearly states that the food operators are not allowed to adulterate the food, like mixing the food with other substances or any other foreign bodies that are not supposed to be there. So it's actually punishable by law. So I think, yeah, so the person who does it can be fined up to ₱100,000 or a 10-year imprisonment or the combination of both.
So we'll go for another quick break. I'm speaking to Dr. Tanju Lin, next generation sequencing scientist. And when we come back, we'll find out about how instances of food fraud can be detected throughout the supply chain. You're listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Soo Ann. I'm speaking to Dr. Tanju Lin, next generation sequencing scientist, about food fraud and instances and the different types of food fraud and when it happens. So in cases where there is suspected food fraud, right, what is the do we know what the process is like to detect whether the food is fraudulent or not? Where do you come in this process?
All right. So for us, we come in as an auditing body.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about this, then we'll have to look at the supply chain as a whole, right?
From start to end.
Yes. So when you look at from the start to end, so it, there will be the suppliers that supply the raw ingredients to the manufacturers. So where we can come in is during that time when the manufacturers receive the raw ingredients from the suppliers, because usually the manufacturers will be given a certificate of analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And it will state like what's in the raw ingredients, what is it. Unfortunately, this certificate can be easily, it may not be real. Like you can actually fake it.
Right.
Right. So in this case, like we can help the suppliers, the manufacturers to check on their raw ingredients, especially when, let's say they're like minced meat, for example, if the suppliers is giving them meat in general, right? We can help them detect what sort of meat is in that minced meat.
So and it's true what you mentioned earlier as next generation sequencing.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
So currently, do we know if this is done consistently?
You mean the auditing part?
Yeah.
I think it is done, but because there are actually some there are labs like in Malaysia and overseas that do this sort of testing, can be chemical testing or DNA testing. So they actually do it. So for example, if let's say, you know, you want to test a particular incoming raw ingredients for horse meat, mm-hmm. you can send it to a lab to test the DNA, to test whether there's horse in it or not. So I think a lot of currently the current method is really to look into whether that specific animal is in the meat or not.
Mm.
But I think one of the challenges with this is that they can only detect that specific meat.
Mm.
So they can't detect anything else. So let's say I'm receiving raw ingredient from my supplier, mm-hmm. and my supplier is telling me that, all right, this is minced beef. So then I will take it and I'll be like, okay, now I want to check if there's horse meat in there. So I'll just send it to a lab and they will test for the presence of horse meat. But that's it. I wouldn't know if there's any other things in there. So this is when I mentioned about next generation sequencing, testing, you know, looking at the DNA profile of all the animals in the meat. So we'll be able to tell that the meat will contain not just horse meat but potentially other animal in there. Mm.
Not just testing for that one very specific thing, but a broader form of testing where you can note everything, but likely everything that is contained in the product.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Do we have any other gaps, or you know, do you see challenges in detecting food fraud, especially when you want to do it throughout the supply chain, right? Because that is what we should be doing.
I think one of the biggest challenges is really, I think people may not be willing to test it. I guess because sometimes some people have the tidak apa mentality. So that kind of, you know, it hasn't happened to me yet, so I don't think there's a need for it. That can be quite challenging. And especially when there are so many things could go wrong along the supply chain, like I mentioned about the potentially fake certificate of analyst. And also when the materials are transported from one facility to another, that product may be tampered during the process. And I think for most food operators, maybe they just look at the nutritional values of the product.
Mm.
So they don't really look what is exactly in the raw ingredients. So let's say I get like an animal feed from my supplier. They would just look at how much protein is there, how mm-hmm. much carbohydrate, fat. But some of them may not even check what is in the raw ingredients itself. So they might not check what's in there. So I think that can be quite challenging.
So, I mean, in that case, then it's just you're just seeing, oh, what type of nutrition is in there, but you don't know where the nutrition is coming from.
Yes, that's right. And we talk about the supply chain. I mean, towards the very end of the supply chain, there's us, the consumers, yeah. right? So I think that we can also play a role in this. If let's say, you know, I mean, especially to the audience listening today, if you spot fake food or like potentially adulterated food, you can report it to the Ministry of Health, the Food and Safety Quality Department. You know, because the problem is that we as consumers, we just, when we go to a supermarket, we'll take it as it is. The labeling says this or is that. But sometimes if you suspect that it could be dodgy mm. of some sort, you can actually report it. You can bring it up. So I think this is really important as us end users to be aware of that too.
From what you see, and I know you mentioned this, the upper attitude, but do you think that Malaysians are becoming more aware or there's still a long way to go?
I think they are getting there. We're getting there. That's because, like, I mean, MOH is really doing a lot of enforcement with the Food Act. I think I think different parties are already trying their best to spread that awareness, especially when there are cases like that and it will appear on news and people read the news. The awareness is there. Probably, I think, it's the enforcement and the lack of action that is you know, probably, yeah, stopping this from happening.
Would you have a final takeaway message for the listeners from this show?
So the demand for food will always, it's always there.
Yeah.
So I think that food fraud is something that is really difficult to prevent. So the most important thing is for people to have that awareness, right? The awareness about these cases and to actually take action about it, because it's not enough to just be aware of something mm. and not take action. So when I say take action, so example for us, we can report it to the MOH. And for the manufacturers, you can really, you know, check whether that certificate of analyze the test is real or not. Yeah, just everyone in the supply chain, you know, they have to play their part.
Thank you so much, Julin.
Thanks for having me again.
I've been speaking to Dr. Tan Julin, a next generation sequencing scientist, about food fraud and particularly looking as well at situation in Malaysia. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.